Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The day the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded, January 28th, 1986, it's one of those moments that makes people remember where they were when it happened. Though the major TV networks had stopped covering those launches live and the fanfare had died down at that point. But because a teacher was going up with a Challenger, Krista McCullough, who taught social studies at Concord High School in New Hampshire, because she was on board with the other six members of the crew, millions of school kids were watching either through NASA's live feed or coverage from this new 24-hour cable news network called CNN. What happens next is the part, of course, that most people remember. Barely more than a minute after liftoff, the Challenger exploded. And it was terrible, of course, gut-wrenching and tragic, and it set off this search for answers and a deep reckoning about how this could have happened. And what we now know is that a small rubber seal called an O-ring inside one of the Challenger's solid rocket boosters didn't seal properly. So about 73 seconds into the flight, just as NASA's mission control called for the shuttle's commander to throttle up the main engines, the damaged seal gave way. Superheated gases burned past the O-ring, cut through the side of the booster, and the shuttle broke apart. And we know this because two NPR reporters had been talking to the engineers at the booster rocket company, Morton Thiokol, who had designed and built the boosters here in Utah. The reporters were Daniel Zwerdling and Howard Berkus. And less than a month after the tragedy, they broke the story about what had happened and how the engineers knew it could happen and how they had even tried to stop that flight. We spoke with Howard this week, who told us about the critical moment in that story, which came on January 27th, the day before the launch.
Well, it actually all started in the afternoon when Bob Ebling, who's one of the Morton Thiokol booster rocket engineers, notices the forecast at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. And it was a forecast well below freezing. He was alarmed by that, because he knew that with the O-rings that seal the rocket joints and the booster rockets in cold weather, they tend to stiffen. And they'd never experienced anything that cold before. He phoned Alan McDonald, the immediate supervisor of the booster rocket engineers. And his response was, well, we better get a conference call together. So while he was getting that conference call together, the engineers and executives at Thiokol met on their own. And they amassed data and documents and photographs of the history of O-ring damage. So they were ready when the NASA people finally joined the teleconference. And the Thiokol executives and engineers were in complete agreement this launch should be delayed. Do not launch below 53 degrees, because there had been a launch at 53 degrees where there was serious damage to two O-rings. That's when the sort of contentious, argumentative conversations began. And one key element of this discussion is that the Thiokol engineers had photographs of the damage that was done to that rocket joint and those O-rings at 53 degrees, and they showed pretty severe damage, those photographs. They really showed that clearly. But in any case, when one of the Thiokol executives told NASA, don't launch tomorrow, there was an immediate response. George Hardy, one of the NASA booster rocket people, responded, I'm appalled that you would make that recommendation, in part because shuttle flights operate under like this set of rules and circumstances. And one of the rules had to do with how cold you could launch. Well, 53 degrees was not one of those rules. So NASA was hearing, well, we've had this rule forever, and now you want to change it. And at one point, Lawrence Malloy, who was one of the top officials at the Marshall Space Flight Center, just bursts out, you know, "My God, Thiokol, when do you want me to launch? Next April?" And at this point, then, the Thiokol executives decide to put NASA on hold and have a private caucus with the engineers. One of the executives says to them, "Are you sure? Are you sure about this?" And they're absolutely certain. No hesitation on the part of four of the engineers in that room. But Jerry Mason, who was the senior Thiokol executive there, says, "We've gone through all this already. This has to be a management decision." And there were four managers in the room, including him. And he turns to the other three managers, and two of them right away say, "We should launch." And the fourth executive is Bob Lund, the vice president for engineering. And he's trying to listen to his guys and hear what they're saying. But he's also an executive. He's part of the executive team. And that's when Jerry Mason turns to him and says, "You know, Bob, it's time to take off your engineering hat and put your executive hat on." And that's exactly what he did. He decided to go along with the other three executives, and Thiokol then got NASA back on the line, and they said, "We're go for launch." And Challenger's fate was set.
3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Control program. Roger, Challenger. Control program confirmed. Challenger now heading downrange.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Howard Berkus has helped produce a radio documentary about the Challenger story for the NPR podcast Up First. And today in the program, he's going to take us through the story, which he has kept covering despite the fact he retired from NPR in 2019. His ongoing connection to it, he says, comes down to his relationship with one man, Bob Ebling.
I had gotten to know Bob Ebling, one of the Challenger engineers. He was one of the engineers who opened up to us and gave us the untold story in February 1986. But he and I had a lot of conversations about what that experience was doing to him physically and emotionally over, you know, years. I mean, I would check in with him every couple of Challenger anniversaries, see how he was doing. I knew how difficult it was for him. And even though he would not let me report what he was saying or identify him, really, for 30 years, he shared a lot. He shared a lot that I would never tell other people about because they were such personal and difficult, you know, details. So, you know, I could not forget him and his experience. I also got to know Roger Beaujolais, another one of the engineers who actually led the effort to stop the launch. He initially, you know, had a very difficult time. I interviewed him on the record and on tape a year after Challenger at his home up in the Ogden area. You know, we kept in touch. I mean, he would call me every once in a while.
Why? Why would he call you? I think that's interesting that he would call you because the story had broken by then. It had maybe even played out. But what was he reaching out to you for?
And this was years later.
Yeah.
And some of it was, this is what I'm doing. I'm consulting and I'm doing these talks. Yeah. And he wanted to let me know. And maybe he was hoping that I could do something with that, you know, to bring more attention to him.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. With Bob Ebling, when he would call me, it was because he wanted to talk about what he was going through.
Yeah.
And he had some other things that happened in his life, some other tragedies that I think made it worse for him in dealing with Challenger. And he would talk to me about those things. So, you know, in many cases, I would stick with a story or a subject because of the people that I connected with while working on that. Hmm. That really explains all of the obsessive, you know, stories I followed for decades is, you know, it's hard to – you can't just put those people aside.
Yeah.
I can't.
Right. So one of the things that I want to ask you – so again, so this is one of those stories that you did the initial reporting on. You came back to it. You know, at times there were these sort of touch points in history, anniversaries, those kinds of things. Was there something new that you learned reporting the story lately? Anything new that's come up?
I learned how key this blow-by of O-rings, this damage to O-rings at 75 degrees was in that conversation that night when the thiokol engineers were trying to convince NASA it was too dangerous to launch.
This does seem like one of the new revelations, I think, of the story. The fact that the booster rocket program had a dicey beginning. As I think it's put in the Presidential Commission, or maybe this is just your language, it was an accident that was rooted in history.
That's what the Presidential Commission reported, because there was blow-by of an O-ring, you know, where these searing hot gases and rocket fuel burn past an O-ring on the second shuttle flight in 1981.
Yeah.
And this continued to happen. And again, you know, there was a you know, a task force set up at Thiokol where the people on that task force, full time, that's all they did was look at the O-ring problem, what can be done to resolve it. And it was a difficult thing to resolve because you had shuttle flights going on constantly and the booster rockets were retrievable booster rockets. So when they fell away from the main engine, they would, you know, fall into the ocean, they'd be retrieved and they'd be brought back to Utah and they would, you know, get all fixed up and they'd be refitted with O-rings and they'd be used again. So there was a cycle of having to reuse those. And you couldn't just stop and redesign them without a major loss of time for the shuttle program. And, you know, it took after Challenger, when they did redesign those booster rocket joints, and they fixed them, they worked for the rest of the program, it took 2.5 years.
But they didn't fix them. They didn't rework them after that second launch where they discovered the blow-by.
No.
As you say in your reporting, 5 years went by. 24 shuttle missions go up after that. No disasters, but it seems clear to some of the people involved that something is lurking, and you mentioned Roger Beaujolais. He writes this memo in your reporting, you say, 6 months before the Challenger explosion. Again, all these years after that second one had gone up when they realized there was a possibly a flaw here. And he writes this. He warned of, quoting what he said in that memo, a catastrophe of the highest order slash loss of life if it wasn't fixed. And it still hadn't been fixed.
Right. That was a result of this Thiokol task force that Roger Beaujolais was heavily involved in. And he was incredibly alarmed, as were the other engineers, by what they were seeing. But stopping the program to fix the O-rings, you know, there would have been a lot of repercussions to that as well. You know, you can fix the joints, which they did. And you can move ahead with all the technology you can muster to try to make the program as safe as possible. But it all still comes down to human beings making decisions about things all along the way that could be a good decision or a fatal decision. And that continues today for the space program. And that will always continue for the space program. There will always be the potential for another Challenger, given human nature.
Yeah. You've talked about the pressures and the forces that were at play that gave NASA this impetus to let's just go forward with this, despite the sense of reluctance that they were getting from these rocket engineers. There had been 5 delays. They wanted to prove they could do this anytime. Just walk us through the things that the dynamics that were at play as NASA is arguing that we should go forward.
I want to point out that we're talking – when we say NASA in this context, we're talking about booster rocket program managers and engineers at the Marshall Space Flight Center. So that's a right. You know, that's a lower level NASA facility.
Well, this will come up, won't it? Because what's the what did the actual NASA people know versus the NASA part that's dealing with the with that's a I guess that's a critical question, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, so there's launch control at the Kennedy Space Center. So one of the issues here is what did the people at the Marshall Space Flight Center convey to the people who actually had to launch control, who actually had the final decision,
right?
Which is nothing except we're okay to go.
Yeah.
And so we don't know. We don't know what would have happened had those people actually been informed. But certainly the NASA officials at the Marshall Space Flight Center, the booster rockets are their thing. They don't want to be the ones to say, you can't launch because our thing isn't ready. Because if we say our thing isn't ready, then that may mean there's something wrong with us too. And some people have written about a kind of corporate culture at the Marshall Space Flight Center at the time that lends to that. I don't know a whole lot about that. But what I do know is that generally speaking, you have a space program that is desperate to prove that they can fly like an airplane, you know, take off and land on a regular schedule. They had a very ambitious schedule that year. With that schedule, you had to be able to launch, come down, turn the booster rockets around and turn the orbiter around. You had other orbiters sort of lined up ready to go. So if you have a delay, you delay other flights perhaps. You're trying to sell yourself to private companies, to the military,
to Congress,
and to scientists. This is the way to get your payloads, your experiments, your satellites up into space in a cost-effective way. You know, they had to prove that they could launch any time of the year, any month of the year, and really in any kind of weather in terms of temperature.
Yeah.
They were planning to launch from the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California as well. That's a much colder place than Florida typically. So, you know, those were pressures. And then there was, you know, waning interest in the space program at the time. The three major broadcast television networks weren't no longer carrying shuttle launches live. They needed to maintain public interest and enthusiasm in order to keep Congress interested in continuing to fund the program as well. And so they had this brilliant public relations plan. They decided to put a teacher in space. 11,000 teachers, you know, applied, and they had lots of attention to that process. And then to Krista McAuliffe was eventually chosen, this high school teacher from New Hampshire.
Winner, the teacher who will be going into space, Krista McAuliffe. Where's that you?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Brian.
What are you most excited about?
Seeing the Earth from that perspective of that small planet, you know, it's such a big place here, but being able to look at it from a new perspective, and I hope I can bring that wonder and that excitement back to the students.
Maybe just a little bit of fright, too?
Not yet. Maybe when I'm strapped in and those rockets are going off underneath me, there will be, but space flight today really seems safe. We had a good example of
her training got a lot of attention, and of course, then millions of school children are watching televisions for the Challenger launch. I mean, there's just a lot of pressure on the people who are making a decision about whether or not to delay. And, you know, how much of that consciously or subconsciously got into their resistance that night, you know, we'll never know.
Yeah.
They some of them claimed later that they didn't feel any pressure to delay. They were merely having an engineering discussion and made a decision based on the data presented to them. That's what they claimed. But so there were, there was a lot riding on keeping that schedule going, getting shuttles launched, and getting that shuttle launch with a teacher in space aboard who was going to attract a lot more attention and be noticed by President Ronald Reagan during his State of the Union address while she was in space.
Howard Berkus. He's a retired investigative reporter for NPR. His radio documentary is on NPR's Up First podcast. It's called Challenger at 40, Lessons from a Tragedy. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Howard Berkus, taking us through the story behind the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger 40 years ago this week. Howard covered the story from here in Utah for NPR, where the shuttle's booster rockets had been designed and engineered. He was one of the reporters who broke the story about the engineers' last-minute efforts to stop the launch and the intense drama that followed when NASA went ahead anyway. Let's talk about January 28th, the day of the explosion, of course. And I want to get to a moment that you've told so vividly in your reporting involving Bob Ebling driving to work the day of the scheduled launch. Would you just take us through this? He's in the car. He's with his daughter, Leslie. And he's desperate, I guess, frantic. Like, tell us about this.
Well, he's angry.
Yep.
He's frustrated. His daughter, Leslie, she was an adult at the time, and, yeah. And she also worked at Thiokol, commuted with him to work. And it's a 30-mile drive from Brigham City out to Promontory, where the Thiokol booster rocket facility is. And she describes how he's pounding on the dashboard.
He was driving, and he said, "We are going to have a catastrophic event today." And he said, the Challenger is going to blow up. Everyone's going to die. And he was beating his hands on his fist, I should say, on the dashboard. And the closer we got, the more intense it got.
They get to Thiokol.
Yeah.
A bunch of Thiokol managers and executives and engineers all gather in the same conference room where the teleconference was held the night before. There's a big screen, TV projection screen there.
Yeah.
So they're all gathered there. They crowd into this room. People are standing off to the side, sitting on the floor. And the four engineers who tried to stop the launch the night before are there. Bob Ebling is there, and his daughter Leslie is sitting next to him. Roger Beaujolais is sitting on the floor in front of them. And Brian Russell is there. And the engineers believed that it was so cold overnight. One of the forecast temperatures was for 18 degrees. NASA's forecast temperature was, I think it was 26 degrees. So it's well below freezing.
Yeah.
It's the coldest launch ever, 30 degrees colder than any previous launch. There's ice overnight on the launch pad. In fact, there's so much ice on the launch pad, they delay the scheduled launch for 2 hours in the morning, hoping that more of that ice will melt. And the engineers from Thiokol, the four key engineers who tried to stop the launch, they're gathered in this conference room watching the launch, and they believed that Challenger would blow up at ignition.
Hmm. That Does Bob believe that?
Bob Ebling believed that. Yeah. Brian Russell believed that. Roger Beaujolais believed that. They thought that it was so cold, the O-rings would have stiffened so much. And, you know, we know if you take a piece of rubber and you stick it in ice water,
yeah,
it's going to get really stiff.
Yeah.
And so they thought that the pressures of ignition on the joints would cause the joints to separate slightly and that the rocket fuel and the burning gases would just burn right through those O-rings and there'd be a huge explosion on the launch pad. And when it didn't explode...
Yeah, it launched.
It launched.
A crowd of some 500 spectators, including 18 visiting school children from McAuliffe's hometown of Concord, New Hampshire, waited anxiously and then counted down.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff.
liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission.
The liftoff appeared flawless. The spectators, including Krista McAuliffe's parents, Grace and Edward Corrigan, watched proudly through tears of joy.
Challenger now heading downrange.
There were a couple of different reactions. So somebody leaned over to Roger Beaujolais and said, "Oh my God, we made it. We made it. It's going to be okay." But Bob Ebling leaned over to his daughter Leslie and said,
"It wasn't over yet. Things weren't clear."
Engines throttling up, three engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
As soon as he said that, that's when the explosion happened. I could feel him trembling, and then he wept loudly. The silence in that room was deafening.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
Roger Beaujolais got up to leave and go to his office, and everybody just, you know, spreads out. They're all gone. Of course, only CNN and NASA, the NASA satellite feed, were live. But of course, once Challenger exploded, all the TV networks jump in with live coverage. And there's a report from Dan Rather anchoring CBS News in which he says,
"Never before in 25 years of Americans in space, never in 25 launches of a space shuttle had a life been lost. Today, that record went down in flames. Tonight, the search for survivors turned up none. The search for answers is just starting."
But the reality is that the engineers, they knew exactly what happened. They had the answers. And that's what Roger Beaujolais told us when we were finally able to get an interview with him and Bob Ebling a few weeks later. They knew exactly what happened right off the bat.
Where were you on January 28th? What do you remember of that day before you dug into the reporting of that story?
So I was in my home office studio in an old mining cabin in Allen Park Canyon here in Salt Lake, which is where I lived and worked at the time.
Wow.
I had a TV on. NPR wouldn't pay for CNN at the time, so I just had a TV on and saw a breaking news story about Challenger blowing up, and then they go to live coverage. I immediately called my colleague at the time who normally covered flights. We did not have somebody there. NPR was one of the news organizations that didn't have anybody there. You know, said, just making sure, you know, have you heard? Of course, she had, and she was getting down there to the Kennedy Space Center. I kind of watched the news and I didn't do much. It took a couple of weeks, almost 3 weeks to be exact, for me to get involved. And that happened because I saw a local TV news report in which an unnamed Thiokol engineer was quoted as saying that Thiokol was coerced into approving the launch. And that got my attention. And I made a few phone calls. And very quickly, I had a name, Bob Ebling. And I called him. And he was distressed. But he said, you know, don't quote me. I won't do an interview. You don't name me. I'm going to get fired if they find out I've talked to a reporter. I'm not going to do an interview. But he did confirm. I couldn't report it because he said I couldn't. But he did confirm that Thiokol was coerced. That was his word, coerced, into approving the launch. This was a Saturday. Nobody was reachable at NPR. So on Tuesday, it's February 19th, 1986, and I called in to the NPR editor, and she said, okay, this is what we're doing today. And in the meantime, what had happened was that two other names of engineers had become public, Alan MacDonald and Roger Beaujolais. They had given closed-door testimony to the Challenger Commission, so their names became public. And I had actually tried to call both of them, didn't get anywhere with that. So I confer with this editor in Washington, Ann Gudenkauf, and a reporter there, Danny Zwerdling. And Danny had also tried to reach Beaujolais and MacDonald. Beaujolais' wife told Danny that Beaujolais was in a hotel room in Huntsville, Alabama. He went to Huntsville to where the Marshall Space Flight Center was as part of the investigation. And she very helpfully told Danny what hotel he was in.
Wow.
So Danny got on a plane headed to Huntsville. And I was sent up to Brigham City to get one of those engineers. And so we had a list of names of Thiokol executives and engineers. And so the first thing I did is I went to the public library in Brigham City.
Right.
Public libraries then carried, you know, stacks and stacks of phone books.
Well, did you think, I'm going to see if I can find out where Bob Ebling in particular, but maybe others, actually live?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to knock on the door.
Oh, yeah.
And see if they'll talk to me.
Yeah.
Because being in person will make a difference, you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
Bob Ebling had already told me on the phone that he wouldn't talk to me.
Right.
That didn't stop me from knocking on his door.
Yeah.
Darlene Ebling, Bob's wife.
You know, wait. You knock on the door.
Yeah.
She comes to the door.
Yeah.
And what happens?
And I say, is Bob home? I tell her who I am. I'm a reporter from National Public Radio. Is Bob home? She goes, he's not home from work yet. And I said, I haven't talked to my editor for hours. Can I use your phone to call my editor? And Darlene Ebling let me in, let me use the phone. And after talking to my editor, she offered me a drink, you know, some water. And we sat and chatted. She never asked me to leave, and I would have left if she did.
Yeah.
She knew that Bob Ebling wouldn't be happy to see me, and he was not when he walked in the front door. He was not happy to see a reporter sitting there. But he was still frantic. He was pacing back and forth between the kitchen and the living room. I'm at the kitchen table. He's going into the living room. The TV's on with, you know, all that video again of Challenger blowing up. And he's just, he's frantic and he's angry. He's wringing his hands. He's shaking his head. He's talking about how Thiokol is unfairly blamed for what happened. It's NASA's fault. He pointed out something in the local newspaper. There was a reference to a railroad overpass that all the Thiokol workers drove under on the way out to the plant that had some graffiti on it, 3 feet high, that said Morton Thiokol murderers. And it's really, really, really got to him that he and his colleagues were being blamed, and he felt that they did not deserve that blame. And so he just unloaded. And again, he said, you know, don't name me. You know, don't record me. They're going to fire me. And he wouldn't let me take notes at first, but he's providing enormous amounts of detail, like minute by minute, what happened the night before the launch.
And you're just trying to remember all of this.
I'm trying to remember. Direct quotes.
Yes.
Names. And finally, I just say, look, there's no way I'm going to get this accurately if I can't take notes. Don't worry. I'm not going to name you. I'm not – you know, no one will see these notes except me, and no one has in the 40 years since. But I'm not going to be able to keep it straight. I need to take notes. And so like Dustin Hoffman and all the President's Men, I am, you know, furiously scribbling all this information. And – he was very, very specific about the things that were said at the in that conference call that really had an impact on the final choice that was made, which was to overrule the engineers. And he was just so distressed, so distressed. Now, simultaneously, and I don't know this because we're 1,700 miles apart and we don't have cell phones in those days, Danny Zwerdling is outside the hotel room door of Roger Beaujolais. And at first, Beaujolais wouldn't open the door, didn't want to talk to him. But Danny stayed there, and they started talking through the door. And Danny can hear Beaujolais just sobbing on the other side of the door, just sobbing. And Danny Zwerdling says to him, look, the world is not going to know the truth unless you open up. And Beaujolais finally did. And again, don't record me, don't name me. But unbeknownst to me, Danny is getting the exact same story. Mm. Almost all the same quotes, the same names, the same timeline of what happened, how it happened, who did what, who said what. So later that evening, we confer. You know, we have our own little teleconference.
Yeah.
Danny's in a hotel. I'm in a hotel in Brigham City. Our editor's in the offices in Washington. And we compare notes, and we're like, oh, my God, we have, you know, these details are astounding. And they're the same. And, you know, they had no way of talking to each other or planning anything. But, you know, the sort of general ethical rule in journalism at the time was you need three sources in order to go with anonymous sources.
Yeah.
And so our editor, Ann, she sent me out to knock on more doors in Brigham City while Danny started writing what we used to call a TikTok, you know, a minute-by-minute account, a play-by-play of what happened that night. So we were able to report after our anonymous interviews with Roger Beaujolais and Bob Ebling, we were able to lay out exactly what happened the night before the launch, the resistance of the NASA, the vociferous resistance of the NASA people in that call, the fact that the Thiokol engineers, you know, had argued for hours, presented data, and then were overruled by their own executives. And because, you know, they wouldn't go on tape, it was just me and Danny Zwerdling talking for 8.5 minutes, which was something that at first Morning Edition at NPR wasn't terribly excited about. But Danny did a fantastic job of writing this sort of play-by-play account. And I came in to talk about the experience specifically with Bob Ebling.
This is Howard Berkus in Brigham City, Utah. A Morton Thiokol engineer here says he prayed as he watched Shuttle Challenger lift off from its launch pad. We can't tell you his name, his job title, or even the color of his hair. His job may depend on this secrecy. But we can tell you something of what he feels, what others may feel about the right stuff gone awry. On January 28th, this man prayed for some divine act that would safely guide Challenger into space. He worried that the seals in the solid rocket boosters would not function properly in the chilly morning air. He feared disaster, but as Challenger rose from Earth, and as all seemed well, he began another prayer, one of thanks. But in mid-prayer, the spacecraft exploded. He sat quietly and cried. Now, 3 weeks later,
that night on network television and local television, they didn't have video of these engineers. So they had a graphic of a tape recorder rolling, and they might have my voice or Danny's voice, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a big story because there was no turning back from that.
Howard Berkus, his new radio documentary, Challenger at 40, Lessons from a Tragedy, appears on NPR's Up First podcast. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Howard Berkus is with us today telling the really dramatic, remarkable story behind the space shuttle Challenger, which exploded 40 years ago this week. Howard was one of the NPR reporters who broke the story about a frantic effort by the engineers of the shuttle's booster rockets in Utah to stop the launch that day.
You mentioned human nature before. Was a human failure as opposed to a mechanical failure. I mean, there was a material mechanical thing that gave way, but it wasn't a mechanical failure. It was a human failure. Will you talk about that, the importance of that distinction and the human component? Because one of the points you make in your story is that this still has critical lessons, as you say, for the space program that are still relevant today.
It was a mechanical failure that could only have happened with the humans who were not you know, recognizing that history of problems with the O-rings, but also their NASA's process for launch decisions was problematic. The lower-level officials at the Marshall Space Flight Center, who had the conference call the night before the launch with the Thiokol engineers and executives, never told the launch management team that there were objections to launching.
Yeah.
They just simply passed on the final Thiokol executive decision of we're okay to launch. So there was this dramatic moment actually at later at a Challenger Commission hearing in which Chairman William Rogers asks four of the top launch officials at NASA, did you know about this? And they all had to say, no, sir. No, sir. We did not. And that did, you know, cause a change in how launch decisions were made. It was no longer just left to the NASA center that was responsible for the particular contract or component. Although I have to say, you know, 17 years later when the Space Shuttle Columbia disintegrated on reentry,
yeah,
the investigation of that pointed to a failure to listen to dissent and to convey problems up the chain at NASA. But those are, you know, human kinds of things that are always going to be part of a process. And in this case, you had the people at the Marshall Space Flight Center seeming unwilling to delay.
Yeah.
You know, they insist that all of their decisions were based on the data that they were presented. But boy, they pushed back hard. And they didn't just listen to what they were hearing. They were filtering it through, it seems, the impact on schedule and on what was at stake. And so the lesson learned, you know, from that is you've got to listen to the people who are telling you the things you don't want to hear. You have to respect dissent. And you have to listen in those extremely high-pressure situations.
What's the characteristic that you need to employ at a moment like that? Humility? Because I'm thinking about several years ago now, this was 2017, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center asked you to come speak to them.
Yes, and the Langley Space Research Center in
right.
Virginia.
Yeah, yeah, let's get Howard Berkus out here and talk to us. And the topic was listening to dissent.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about what's the message you give and what do you think – because you sound like you can guard against some of this, but the human nature part means there's always going to be something present. So how are you thinking about all of those kind of human dynamics in the story?
I think it's something we all face mm-hmm. in our daily lives, the pressure to do something that might not be the right thing to do at the right moment, but we have pressures on us to do it, you know, whatever it is, and to be late for work, you know, but I got this other thing I want to do, but if I'm late for work, there'll be these repercussions. And so I think we face these similar kinds of things. We just don't have lives at stake necessarily when we deal with them. It's just human nature to want to follow through with what you've said you're going to do. And then you add all kinds of pressures on top of that. The world is watching.
Yeah.
There's humongous amounts of money at stake. Your professional reputation to some degree is at stake. There's so much that can weigh into that. And so my message when I went to NASA centers to deliver talks at their invitation, you know, was that you need to pay attention with when somebody is telling you the worst things you don't want to hear. That was primarily the message, is listening when somebody is telling you something you don't want to hear. Really listening and having first and foremost in mind, you know, the health and safety, the lives of the people, you know, that are at stake in what you're being told. But I think more important than me doing that is that Brian Russell, one of the engineers that night for Morton Thiokol, has been doing that since April of last year. He's been going to NASA centers. He's been to headquarters. He's been to the Johnson Space Center, the Kennedy Space Center, and he's been to the Marshall Space Flight Center twice, as recently as November, talking about the Challenger experience from somebody who went through it. And, you know, his message is that you have to pay attention in those extremely high-pressure situations. You have to pay attention to what is being said. You know, you've got to try to screen out all the other stuff and focus on what you're being told so that you make the right choices. That's what his message has been. And I think that's important that people hear that, you know, from somebody who went through it.
Howard, do you think there's been a full accounting of what went wrong in that story?
There has been an accounting. Some people lost their jobs pretty quickly. Some people stayed on. But, you know, some people thought that Thiokol should have been thrown out of the space program. But they – Alan MacDonald was put in charge of redesigning those booster rockets, and Brian Russell played a big role in that. And they fixed those rocket joints. So I think that just reflecting back on those lives lost, those, you know, those astronauts and Krista McAuliffe, who so many people connected with in a visceral way, and then watched the spacecraft blow up that had her and those other astronauts inside. I think that those losses really drive home for people who were involved. You know, now some of the NASA people claim, you know, till their deaths that they did the right thing based on the information they had. And but, you know, I think about Brian Russell, too, by the way, the Thiokol engineer. He was a lot younger than the other engineers. And he stayed at Thiokol for the rest of his career and the company that absorbed Thiokol. He didn't retire until 2015. Yeah. And he played a very major role in the redesign of those booster rockets, and that was successful. And when I've talked to him recently, you know, he still has a hard time with his role that night, the night before the launch. He feels that he should have spoken up when the Thiokol executives overruled the engineers. They got NASA back on the line, and Thiokol said, we're go for launch.
The thing that I feel the most guilt over, and the thing I wish so badly I had said, I wish I'd have said there's a dissenting view here. I wish the people on the phone call would have heard that. Now, whether it would have changed things, I don't know. But I still wish that would have come out. So I regret that.
To this day.
To this day.
So Challenger is as visceral for some people today as it was in 1986, especially the families of the astronauts, but some of those people who were directly involved who are still alive.
Yeah.
And the lessons learned that they talk about are absolutely critical today, because nothing's changed in terms of the human involvement in these decisions and the, you know, the ability, the desire to want to not delay and just move ahead, you know, in whatever way that might come up. And then today you've got, you know, these big commercial companies that are going to be putting NASA astronauts into space, and they have profit motives and they have other things to prove to the world.
Yeah.
One of the good things is that, you know, NASA invited me to speak to two NASA centers about lessons of Challenger. Brian Russell, the former Thiokol engineer, has spoken at NASA centers about the lessons of Challenger. And there's been a program at NASA for 10 years called Lessons Learned about Challenger and Columbia and the Apollo disasters. And Mike Cianilli, who ran that program, has spoken to thousands and thousands of NASA people, NASA workers, and the contractors. He talked to Jeff Bezos face-to-face about the lessons that are learned from Challenger and these other disasters. So there is an effort to keep those lessons, you know, alive there. Mm-hmm. There is some concern that with budget cuts at NASA and what, 4,000 people lost their jobs there last year, how that will continue into the future. But I have to say that I think those are examples of how NASA has embraced the concept of we need to learn from this and we need to pass this on. Because as Mike Cianilli says, Challenger is about the future of spaceflight.
So you talked about Howard Brian Russell, his reaction, which has inspired him to, you know, speak about the lessons. Talked about Roger Beaujolais, same thing, processing that, the difficulty he went through, stayed with him. And of course, Bob Ebling, which is sort of where I want to sort of finally come to, is the, for all the poignancy and despair that Bob went through, and there's a lovely kind of coda at the end that we need to talk about, and something that I think you did for him. I hope you'll at least think of it that way, that you did for him, that it was some sort of peace that you were able to bring to Bob in his last days.
I'll be honest with you. I was being a reporter. I was following where the sort of story led. I, on the 30th anniversary of the Challenger disaster on January 28th, 2016, I called my editor and I said, you know, I kept in touch with this engineer from Challenger over the years, and he's never gone on the record. You know, he was one of our sources in 1986. He's never talked about what it's been like for him since that day, and it's been tough for him, and he's never gone on the record. And I'm thinking about calling him today. What do you think? And my editor goes, why are you asking me? Get in the car and get up there. You know? And I called him up, and he said, sure, come talk to me. I'm ready to talk. And he agrees, you know, to be recorded and to go on the record. And I had thought that he would have gotten past the guilt because he played a big role in the rescue of the Bear River Bird Refuge after flooding from the Great Salt Lake. He was a volunteer there and he raised money and he helped actually get the refuge, you know, restored and rebuilt. And he was even honored for that at the White House by the president. He was the Conservation Volunteer of the Year. And I thought, oh, you know, this must, you know, have really helped him get over it. But he was exactly like he was that day in 1986 when he said to me, I should have done more. I could have done more.
Everything is all right with you. I still have this guilt complex.
He still felt that he failed those astronauts, that he was responsible for their deaths. And he said something to me, you know, he was a very religious person, and he prayed a lot, and he said,
I think that was one of the mistakes that God made. He shouldn't have picked me for that job. I don't know. But next time I talk to him, I'm going to ask him, why me? You picked a loser.
When I put that on the air in a story that night, we were inundated with hundreds of emails and phone calls and letters from listeners, most of whom wanted to comfort him. And a lot of them were engineers who said, you did what engineers are supposed to do. You presented the data. You presented the facts. You are not the decision maker. This is not your fault. Yeah. And I started feeding all of that to his daughter, Kathy, who was living with him and taking care of him at the time. And she would read them to him. His eyesight was so bad, he couldn't read stuff himself. And she was reading all these things to him. And I went back up there, you know, thinking, okay, well, maybe this made a difference.
You and your colleagues did all that you could do.
That's right. It's easy to say, but after hearing that, I still have that guilt right here.
He points to his heart, and he says,
you aren't NASA, you aren't Thiokol. I haven't heard any of those people.
He's never gotten confirmation that he did do his job and he was a good worker and he told the truth.
So I thought, all right, I'll try to find some of those people. And I managed to find two of the people who were involved that night in 1986 from NASA, George Hardy, who had famously said, I'm appalled at what you're suggesting that we delay this launch. And sadly, George wouldn't do an interview with me. He was in his 80s at that time. He wouldn't do an interview with me. But he did send me an email with messages for Bob Ebling. He said, you and your colleagues did everything that was expected of you. The decision was a collective decision made by several NASA and Thiokol individuals. You should not torture yourself with any assumed blame.
Thank you.
I got in touch with Bob Lund, the guy from Thiokol, who famously took off his engineering hat and put his management hat on and was the deciding vote in overruling the engineers and approving the launch anyway, despite their objections. He also wouldn't do an interview. He told me he would call him, and then I called him back, and he told me he did talk to Bob, and he told him, you know, this is not your burden to bear. And I also then got in touch with NASA. The director of NASA at the time was an astronaut who was supervising the redesign of the booster rockets and getting NASA back to space. And I thought, well, maybe he'd have something to say, you know. He wouldn't talk to me. But a spokeswoman issued a statement, and I read that statement to Bob.
So they're talking about the astronauts. We honor them not through bearing the burden of their loss, but by constantly reminding each other to remain vigilant and to listen to those like Mr. Ebling who have the courage to speak up so that our astronauts can safely carry out their missions.
Bravo! I've had that same thought many, many times.
Looked like a miracle. And I asked him what, you know, he had to say to the people who wrote to him.
Thank you. You helped bring my worrisome mind to ease. You have to have an end to everything.
When I left, he was still like clapping over his head. He was smiling. He was just, he was buoyant. And his daughter Kathy told me he had changed completely. He died 3 weeks later. And Kathy said he was at peace.
Howard Berkus, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me talk about all this again. I appreciate it.
Howard Berkus, he retired from NPR in 2019, though as you can tell, he hardly stopped working. His radio documentary about this story is now on the NPR podcast Up First. It's called Challenger at 40, Lessons from a Tragedy. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Aidan Oneida is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.